again, everybody. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. And I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, who's the center's other co-director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on Apple iTunes, also on the Android site, and also on our website, which is lawandreligionforum.org. Well, today we're going to do something a little bit different on Legal Spirits. You know, we usually talk about current events or we have interviews with people writing about recent things, but now we're going to do something a little different. We've done this in the past sometimes too. We're going to talk about something very old and at the same time very current, so a paradoxical topic. We're talking today about Augustine's City of God, which is, of course, a work written thousands of years ago by St. Augustine, broadly speaking, about the relationship between the church and state, or between Christians and the world around them. So that's pretty old, but it's also something very current, because as we said in one of our podcasts earlier this year, President Biden referenced Augustine in his inaugural address in January, and that got a lot of attention from people. So what we're going to do today is talk about some of the major themes in Augustine's work in City of God, specifically his concept of the two cities, the city of God and the city of man, which somehow have to negotiate this world between them. And then we'll talk about President Biden's reference to Augustine in his inaugural speech and sort of interrogate that and see, well, why did President Biden cite it? And did President Biden cite it in a way that Augustine himself would have understood? Okay, so Mark, do you want to say anything before we begin?
Sure. And this is going to be a lot of fun. And just, I guess, two prefatory notes. One is for listeners that, you know, Mark and I, we are not Augustine scholars. Augustine has been the subject of, no surprise, millennia worth of scholarship and thought and exegesis and so on. And there are many, many, many more erudite and important thinkers than the two of us with respect to Augustine's thought. So for you,
so now no one's going to listen to us at all, Mark.
Well, in fact, that may include some of the listeners out there. But then the second point, a related point, is that part of what we're talking about today concerns the reflections that we brought to bear in our Center for Law and Religion Reading Society, which is this group of that assembles every once or twice every semester to talk about a classic work of either literature or history or philosophy involving law and religion. And so some of the reflections that we had just a couple of days ago were, we decided that it would be a good idea to perhaps bring them to a larger audience. So this is just a couple of guys talking about Augustine and reflecting on some of the themes that were raised in the books that we read together, but we think that we can perhaps add something, if not completely fresh, at least interesting to the conversation.
Yes, and you know, Mark, you're quite right. And I console myself by thinking if we say anything wrong, then that will at least get people to go and read Augustine. And so that in itself will be a good thing. Well, why don't we just start with a little introduction to Augustine for some people who might not know that much about him. He was a saint he is a saint in the Christian tradition, and he's one of the most influential thinkers in Western philosophy, and City of God, the work that we'll discuss, is one of his most important works. Augustine was born in North Africa, which was then part of the Roman Empire, in the 4th century, in the year 354. So this was a period of decline for the Western Roman Empire. Augustine famously tells the story of his life in Confessions, which is a classic of Western literature, sort of begins the confessional literature in the West. I'd say that's probably better known than City of God and maybe more influential, more broadly influential. Augustine's mother, St. Monica, was a Christian, but his father wasn't. And in Confessions, Augustine says that he led a rather dissolute, careerist life. He was quite talented. He had a way with people. And he had great professional success. He eventually became a professor of rhetoric in Rome. But when you read Confessions, you see he was rather alienated by his life. He was disappointed in what the world had to offer. I think that comes through in book 19 of City of God too. We'll talk about this, Mark. I mean, in book 19, he says again and again, there's really nothing in this world that can make us truly happy. And I think that is a reflection of his own psychology, as well as a more general observation he makes. He famously gave up his career at some point. He converted to Christianity. He returned home to Africa and was quickly made a priest and then a bishop. And he was a very busy man. I mean, as a bishop, you know, Mark, you and I are both lawyers. It's sort of endearing. He was a lawyer. He was a judge, really, resolving lots of cases. We have records of his opinions that are still extant. But at some point, I guess around the year 410, he decided to write this book, The City of God. And maybe it was after that, actually, I should say. But the impetus for writing The City of God was something that happened in 410, and that was the fall of Rome, the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And City of God was written by Augustine in large part to respond to people who said that Rome had fallen, at least in the West, because the city had become Christianized, because the empire had become a Christian empire. And there were people who were saying that once that happened, the Roman gods had deserted the city, and also the Christian God really couldn't do anything to protect the city. Mark?
In fact, the first half of City of God really is a kind of defense that way against these sorts of accusations. It's not the part of City of God that we focused on for the students, because it's not the more famous and perhaps more substantive with respect to Augustine's vision, but it is probably much more important for understanding Augustine's motivations for undertaking the work in the first place.
Yes. Okay. So as you say, we're not going to talk about that so much. That's really something more for historians to discuss. We're going to talk about one of the major themes of the book. And this book has been extremely influential in how Christians have seen their place in the world ever since it was written, really, at least in the West. And in the book, Augustine describes politics, or the political society, as an interaction between two cities. Today, I think we'd say two communities. And these two cities are defined, Augustine says, by different loves. There's the city of God, which is defined by the love of God. And then there's the city of man, which is defined by the love of the world. So what I'd like to do first, Mark, is talk a little bit about the first city, about at least how I understand what Augustine is saying about the first city. And I think this is very important. So again, the city of God is the community of people that love God, that live according to God. And of course, Augustine means Christians. He doesn't mean a generic God. He means the Christian God. And I think it's very important to understand, if you want to understand Augustine, to understand that he sees the city of God as a community of pilgrims. He says it again and again, that Christians are sojourners in this world, that the city of God is comprised of pilgrims. And, you know, what's the important thing about pilgrims? What's the characteristic of pilgrims? They're not home. They're traveling. They're on the road. They don't really fit in where they are. They are strangers. In addition, pilgrims have to bear hardships. In fact, the hardships are often part of the pilgrimage, you know, a test that the pilgrims must endure if they have to make progress. And to my mind, this is really essential to understand about Augustine, that he sees Christians essentially as strangers in a political society. Christians are just passing through. They're trying to get to their eternal home. They're aliens. You know, alienage from this life is an essential part of the Christian condition. Now, that's not original to Augustine. You know, those people who know the New Testament will recognize many of these references from the letter to the Hebrews, in which the author repeatedly compares people of faith to a separate city, you know, pilgrims in this world. And I'm not going to quote all the passages. I think some of our listeners will know them. But there's one especially important one in which the author of the letter to the Hebrews says, "Here we have no continuing city." And he says, just as Christ had to leave the city of Jerusalem, he was crucified outside the city, so Christians also have to go outside the city to find their true calling. Again, "For here we have no continuing city, but we seek the one that is to come." So I think that's where I'd begin understanding Augustine, that Christians are apart, are aliens. What do you think, Mark?
Well, so this is very interesting, and actually I quite agree actually with the basic reading and interpretation of the idea of the two cities and the idea of Christians as pilgrims. And in fact, one can trace in modern theology the influence of this kind of idea in such great thinkers as Stanley Hauerwas and others who have really picked up on the idea of Christians as strangers, as aliens to any given political community. Having said that, I also think that that's not the whole story, or there's an additional part of the story, and maybe we can just sort of pick up with respect to at book 14, where you have this very famous line where Augustine says, quote, two cities have been formed by two loves, the earthly by the love of self, even to the contempt of God, and the heavenly by the love of God, even to the contempt of self. And the question is, so how do we interpret this language? Well, you can interpret it in a number of ways. There's a wonderful book by Miles Hollingworth, An Intellectual History of Augustine, where he says, from its inception, Christianity had always had to negotiate the ancient expectation that religion and politics should form a single piece. So in addition to, I would think, in addition to the idea of Christians as pilgrims, there's the kind of basic idea in American law of the separation of church and state. So both the idea that individual people have this kind of dual, almost like a magnetic needle on a compass, you know, oscillating between the two poles is the way that Hollingworth puts it. It sort of quivers between the poles, between the earthly city and the heavenly city. And individuals have the power on the basis of the power to choose, of human choice, one or the other city. But also as a society, the idea that these are separate societies, the society of God and the society of humanity. Well, so if people are free to choose the city that they love, which city will they choose? Well, the Christian, Augustine says, should choose to love the heavenly city. And that was, in fact, the problem for Christians in Rome, that Christian citizens were not trustworthy because the Christian was liable to choose the wrong city. You're not invested as much as we are. You don't take as seriously as we do the things of this world. They don't treasure earthly things as ultimate ends, whereas the Romans did. They idealized this world because this was the only world that there was. In some ways, scholars have made analogs to the sort of situation that we are in now. Many people say that this is the only world we have, and so we've got to give it all that we have and love this world as much as we possibly can while we're on it. So yes, Augustine distinguishes these two realms, these two worlds, and he says that Christians have to have ultimate love for the next world. But I don't think that that means, I don't think that Augustine thought that it meant that Christians were to withdraw from the earthly city. In fact, they had an important role to play in the earthly city. Christians were not to withdraw from that city. He says, quote, for the earthly city, which shall not be everlasting, has its good in this world and rejoices in it with such joy as things can afford. This language that you see that you mentioned, Mark, about Christians as pilgrims or as wanderers. Well, wanderers stop for a while in particular places, right? They sojourn is the language that Augustine uses in particular places. Even the saints have to sojourn in the earthly city before moving on to the heavenly city. And so what do? Do they just sort of sit around and wait, or like stay home or something like that? It says, no, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to sort of establish your identity exactly by refusing to be sort of subsumed in the ways of the earthly city. And by doing that, you can improve in a small way, but in an important way, the life of the earthly city, perhaps by converting people to your way of thinking, or even if they don't convert, simply by making a better life than would otherwise be possible within the earthly city. So to be a kind of, the Latin word is peregrinus, right? To be like a peregrine falcon, right? To be a pilgrim or a wanderer follows from, as you say, the primary allegiance to the heavenly city. But you're also, as a wanderer, you're a resident alien, right? You have to stop and make the best of the place that you're in. And that means you have attendant commitments to improve the earthly city, if only to avoid the absolute worst than that the earthly city can offer. So that's a kind of an additional perhaps gloss or addendum to the idea that you were talking about.
Yeah, I understand that, Mark. I agree. I would quibble with your use of the word wanderer. I think wanderer suggests it's kind of aimless or something like that. I mean, Augustine does know they're going someplace. They're on a path to the eternal kingdom. And I agree with you that he says that, okay, well, these two cities are intermingled, which means you have to have something to do with the earthly city while you're here. You can certainly use its peace and security, you know, to do your pilgrimage. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, it reminds me of another very famous quote from Augustine about philosophy, in which he said the Christians should take the best of pagan philosophy. They should spoil the Egyptians, right? Just like the Hebrews did in the Old Testament. And I think he feels maybe that way about the earthly city too. Christians should, you know, use it to their advantage and also, you know, not misuse it, not abuse it either. But it does seem to me this is maybe, we're just saying the same thing with slightly different emphases, that he does think in the end Christians are aliens here. And also, you know, it's interesting when you compare this to contemporary meliorist liberalism. I don't think he expects too much from the earthly city. There's really not that much you're going to get from this. It's not going to be, I mean, you know, chapter 19 of the book is all about how terrible this earthly life is. And I don't think he expects it's ever going to be perfected. That's just impossible. So that is a real big difference.
A very big difference. I agree. And a big difference in 19, he talks a great deal about Stoic philosophy and about philosophy of the classical world, of the ancient world more broadly. And he has some very harsh words for it. He has some harsh words that, you know, that people that think that virtue, for example, the sort of Aristotelian ideas about virtue as the ultimate end or the ultimate human excellence, that these people are essentially fools. That they have mistaken the ultimate end, and look at all of the terrible things that happen to people, happen to their bodies, that happen to their minds. It leads them to all kinds of excesses and so on. Still, I think there is a kind of sense in even in Book 19, as dark as it is, that that it's almost properly chastened, let's say. Properly contained and with the right sort of perspective, these are the ideas of the ancients are the best that this is sort of the best that humans have to offer who don't see this other world, and it, you know, Mark, as I'm talking, it actually it reminds me a little bit of Dante, right? If you think about Dante and the way that he constructs his Inferno. You know, there's the initial circle there, right? Which is just the circle of the. I mean, there are a lot of fantastic, very important and interesting classical thinkers that get relegated to that sort of threshold circle of hell before you really get into the really bad folks, right? So yes, right, they're in hell, right? they didn't make it, but it's perhaps not quite as horrible a hell as you know, with the place of Judas Iscariot and all the rest of them. So maybe we're talking about degrees here, but degrees, I do agree within an overall architecture of wretchedness.
And of course this, and you know, just to circle back, this has been a very important idea in Western politics. I mean, church-state relations, that, okay, however you negotiate the boundaries, in some essential way, Christians are a separate community. I mean, maybe a duality, maybe it's not as harsh as, you know, complete separation, but and that is different from other civilizations, which don't have this divide between the city of God and the city of man. You know, there are other civilizations, other religions, which are much more unified in this way, in which government is part of the city of God. And at least in Augustine, I understand there's millennia of reflection on this. You see a real divide there, which I would argue goes right back to Hebrews and maybe even back to the gospel account of Caesar and God.
Yeah. And
okay.
Thoughts, Mark, about this, because we actually didn't have time to raise this with the group, but there's a long discussion about justice in book 19 and how the methods of the judge to include torture and other sorts of are both ineffective and show exactly the limits of human justice, of what human justice can accomplish. Even the best judges, the wisest judges, are susceptible of these failings. And it's not just, you know, the specific coercive methods used by particular judicial systems. He thinks that this is a universal problem. It doesn't, you know, if you avoid torture, let's say, are you going to avoid these problems? The answer is no. And I just wanted to read this quote from Oliver O'Donovan. He says, "We shall miss the point of this if we confine ourselves to observations of the barbarous laws of evidence which obtained in the late empire. For Augustine, it's a universal problem about judicial process everywhere. It's a guess as to which party is lying and which is telling the truth. And any inquisitorial process adopted to reduce the element of hazard may backfire and defeat its own end." So I think that there is a kind of darkness which chastens the virtues here. That look, you know, as good as the virtues can ever be, they can only accomplish so much. And yet, that's at least something more and better than if there were no virtues at all, perhaps.
I guess. I mean, look, I think we should also point out Augustine had a very strong view of original sin, that this was something that basically clouded all human endeavor. And he says in that passage you're talking about, even, you know, a judge can never be quite sure who told the truth and who didn't. The judge can never be quite sure if the person he is sentencing to prison or worse was actually guilty. And that is because, you know, we have very imperfect knowledge after original sin. Okay, now I do want to talk about the inauguration, because, of course, President Biden said nothing about any of this in his inauguration. What he referred to was a different quote. He referred to Augustine's definition of a people, what we would today call a nation, right, a community. And here's what President Biden said. He said, "Many centuries ago, St. Augustine, a saint of my church, wrote that a people was a multitude defined by the common objects of their love. What are the common objects that we love? I'm sorry, what are the common objects we love that define us as Americans? I think I know. Opportunity, security, liberty, dignity, respect, honor, and yes, the truth." And then he goes on to talk about how recent weeks and months have taught us a painful lesson. There are truth and there are lies. I have to say, as I read this, I reflect that Augustine was a rhetorician. I wonder what he would make about contemporary American political rhetoric. I'm not just trying to criticize President Biden. I think generally, probably Augustine would think our standards of rhetoric are not what he would have seen as a rhetorician in ancient Rome. But okay, that's what President Biden was talking about. A people is a multitude defined by the common objects of their love. Now, here's the passage that President Biden was alluding to. He was talking about, this is in book 19, in which St. Augustine says, this is what a people is. A people is defined by the object of its love. And some loves are higher and some loves are lower. And a people will be superior in proportion as it is bound by higher loves and higher interests, and inferior as it is bound together by lower loves and lower interests. And one of the things we talked about with our students the other day was, okay, well, in fact, is America a people according to Augustine's definition of what a people is? I mean, we can understand why President Biden spoke the way he did. He was being, you know, encouraging and hortatory. It's useful for us to think of ourselves as united by common love. But is that in fact true, Mark?
Well, difficult to answer that question, but I thought it was interesting to hear our students' various perspectives. There were some students who were skeptical that America is bound together by a common love. And in fact, I think it's probably true that there's a strong strain in classical liberalism that is very much opposed to thinking about nations, about peoples as bound together by thick loves, by thick common loves, right? In fact, you can see in James Madison's writing, for example, the desire to kind of tamp down some of these strong, strong loves, loves of the past, love of land, or love of religion, common loves of religion, and so on. In fact, one might even say, talking about religion, religion is kind of the prototypical common love
of
a nation that has to be tamped down.
Of course.
Individual interest, right? Individual gain is what binds us, right? And everyone pursues their own gain, and the gain of the common market and the aggregation of individual interest. That's what America is about. So that was one kind of idea or response that we saw. But another kind, which I also thought was interesting, was to say, no, we do have continue to have certain common loves, provided that two things are true. Number one, that we state them as abstractions or ideals. That's what America has. We're sort of a creedal nation of common loves. And number two, again, that we don't get into too many particulars about what that means concretely, so long as we state them as at that kind of general level in the way that President Biden did. So those are the sort of the two reactions that I saw, Mark. What did you see?
I saw those reactions, and I have to say, I thought one of them was actually much closer to the truth than the other. I mean, to my mind, this is very anachronistic to look back to St. Augustine and say, well, you know, he defined a nation as a, you know, people committed to a common love, and that's just what we are in America today. Actually, our founding ethos is not that. Our founding ethos is much more akin to John Locke. And John Locke, if you remember, said government has nothing to do with these things that Augustine would think of as higher loves. Government is about protecting property and the indolence of the body and all of this kind of thing. It's not about big commitments and loves. And it seems to me that that's much closer to the way we Americans have understood things than Augustine is. That's how it seems to me. And also, even if Augustine is right, and even if that was our hope, that we would be united by common loves, it sure doesn't seem that way now. I mean, just think about the pandemic we're going through. I mean, you would think if there's one thing could unite people, it is the desire to end suffering and or minimize suffering and preserve health and whatever. And people are totally in disagreement about these things. You know, even our pandemic has become infiltrated by partisanship. You know, you can sort of tell what somebody thinks depending on who he or she supported in the last election. And that certainly doesn't seem like common love.
Yeah, and I think even one way to think about this is even the words that President Biden used to describe our common loves, liberty, security, the truth, I think these are radically contested ideas in a way that perhaps they were not in the past. Obviously, you're always going to have different ideas among a people about precisely what those abstractions, how they get sort of cashed out or what they mean in a concrete way. But I think other than the words themselves, which I suppose people can still rally around something like security, it's better to be secure than to be insecure as a general matter, or to be free than not to be free. I think there's perhaps a great more disagreement today about what those ideals mean and whether they are ideals in the first place, how do they to be balanced against other ideals that in the past. And that may be, as you say, you know, as we've talked about, exactly because of the rejection of this Augustinian idea, which I should add, that too is not original to Augustine, right? These are fundamentally Aristotelian and even Platonic ideas about the nature of a polity, what a polity is and what it shares. So as much as Augustine tries to get away from the philosophers and to say that they aren't all that there is and there is an exity, he tends to rely on them a lot, even in his own ideas about what it is that forms a polity.
Well, that comes back to his point about we should spoil the Egyptians, right? Let's take from the philosophers the best that they can give us, just like the Hebrews took all the jewels and the gold from Pharaoh and fled, right? That's just what we should do too. Let's take all the good stuff and leave the philosophers to the Red Sea. So look, and I want to say, look, I say none of this with, you know, enthusiasm. I mean, it it probably would be good if we could find a way to unite ourselves as Americans, and maybe we can. But at the moment, as I say, it seems this is kind of an anachronism. I don't think this is the major stream in American political life or Western liberalism. And it's hard to see it right now. Now, of course, there are some people, we have colleagues and friends who talk about replacing liberalism as the guiding force in the West. And maybe those people could look back to Augustine for support about, well, a nation really is, well, now we hear a lot about the common good. And that sounds a lot like common loves to me.
Sure. We hear a lot about the common good. We hear a lot about identity politics today. So it might be that that while the nation as a nation doesn't have common loves, perhaps individual groups within the nation have common loves in the way that Augustine was talking about, true views about the highest ideals and so on. And perhaps over time, those will constitute, or those will come to constitute, the nation's loves, right? The nation's true loves.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, that's all we have time for today. We hope, as Mark said, neither of us are experts here. We're just a couple of guys talking, but we hope at least we've raised some interesting issues for people to think about. And as I said, if we're wrong about any of this, then that will only encourage you to go and read Augustine, which is what you really should be doing. So thanks for listening. For now, this is Mark Movsesian and Mark DiGirolami for the Center of Law and Religion with another episode of Legal Spirits. You can find past episodes archived on Apple iTunes and Android, and also at our website, lawandreligionforum.org. See you next time.